Hello, this is Sue Beer.
And this is Emma Roberts.
And welcome to this call. We're going to be talking about using heart-centered EFT for problem-solving, personal growth, health, and happiness. First of all, I'd just like to say welcome and hope you're enjoying working through the Healing the Addicted Heart package. And thank you very much for sending in the questions. We've got some great ones lined up. I think we'll make a start with the questions around the heart anchor and the tapping, the heart-based tapping itself. So maybe first of all, to remind ourselves, should we do a round of heart-based tapping? Does that sound like a good idea, Emma?
That sounds like a great idea to me.
Yeah, okay. Because I'm sure you'll have noticed that the heart-based EFT tapping that we do differs from straight EFT in that we're not using a setup, and we're also using the heart point. So let's just do that now, if you can, if you put your non-dominant hand on the heart point. Okay, and just take a moment to maybe breathe in as you just get a sense of that point. And then with your dominant hand, tap the eyebrow point.
Okay.
And then side of the eye. Under the eye, under your nose, chin point, and then on the collarbone point, which is going to be just above where your hand is holding the heart point. And then finishing up on the top of the head point. And we always like to take a nice deep breath in after completing a round. Okay. Now, I don't know if you notice a kind of feeling of warmth or relaxation just from tapping the points, stimulating the end points of the meridians, whether or not you're tuning into anything specifically as you're tapping.
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel?
Feels good to me. Good. Did you deliberately leave out the underarm point?
Yes, I've deliberately left out the underarm point. It's in the interest of streamlining the whole process for working on ourselves, because that's essentially what we're doing when we're working through the Healing the Addicted Heart five stages of transformation material. We may work with other people, but generally it's a kind of internal voyage. And what we want is to absolutely streamline the amount of words that we use, the number of tapping points that we use. So effectively what we've got is missing out of the underarm point, and we're missing out doing a traditional setup. However, and this is one of the questions that quite a few people have asked, why don't you do a setup with the heart-based EFT tapping? And this also kind of links in with several of the questions that we've had about using the heart anchor. Because what we are doing is using the heart anchor, and in a sense, that does replace, it does several things actually, but it does replace using the setup for the purpose of correcting psychological reversal.
Okay.
And where I'd actually like to begin with is telling you a little bit about the background to how I chose the heart anchor points to use and how that does fit in with the whole idea of psychological reversal.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. Also, that's not even in the book, is it?
It's not in the book, and this is actually the first place where we have kind of recorded any material about. You know, this is actually a really, really important piece of working with heart-based EFT, so it's great to have the opportunity to do that now.
Absolutely. And it's a good story too. It's very interesting.
Okay, so as you know, we use the heart point, so we're putting one hand in the middle of the chest area on the heart point, and then with our other hand, we're putting that right at the back of the head where you would cradle a baby's head. And we're just using a very light pressure kind of either side of the base of the skull. So one way to think about it is that with the flat of your palm, you're pressing that kind of bony, slightly bulging area on one side of the brain stem, and then with your fingertips, you can have a very light pressure on the symmetrical point on the other side. So does that make sense, that you've got that cradling of the head feeling, and you're also just putting a light pressure on two points which are literally either side of the brain stem at the base of the skull?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So the question is, you know, why decide on these points? Now, I'm going to have to say that originally it was purely intuition. It was just the thought of using these points came to mind. But it was slightly triggered by something that I'd seen on Gary Craig's set of DVDs. You know, the Steps Towards Becoming the Ultimate Therapist set?
Second set, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, the second set. And there's I think it might be an acupuncturist actually on one of the videos there who talks about rubbing these two points at the base of the skull, either side of the brainstem, and it's kind of almost like a sort of throwaway comment as is being, you know, picked out of the audience, that these two points would serve to replace tapping either the karate chop point or the sore spot in terms of correcting psychological reversal. And I must have just kind of stored that up, just thinking, you know, it was an interesting idea, and maybe played around a little bit with those two points until the sort of intuitive thought came to link that with the heart point. And then there was kind of like an additional layer of understanding when I realized that something really quite profound and deep potentially happened when we connected up those two points. Almost like there's kind of like literally a connection, that like a mind-body connection or heart-to-brain connection that's held within our hands. And we now know from the various neurocardiological research that is available to us that there is this pathway that runs between the emotional brain and the heart, and a constant dialogue that's operating at an unconscious level all the time. So lots of things that kind of, you know, came to me and others, you know, intuitively, you know, are being kind of backed up by the research that's available. But I was kind of intrigued myself about the meaning of these points, and that, as you know, Emma, you know, you and I are not great ones for knowing what, you know, each meridian end point is, or, you know, what it stands for, or, you know, what organs it links up with. We're both very much kind of language-based intuitive therapists, aren't we?
I think that's fair to say.
However, I was kind of curious to know what an acupuncturist would make of using these two points together. So I had some correspondence with a guy whose work I like a great deal. And this is what he said. I'll read from the email exchange that we had at one point, because that's probably the best way to get it over. But he said that the area on the chest, which is the heart point which we're using, that will be REN 17, which is a point for the heart and therefore calming. Well, I think we, you know, I certainly get that experience and got that straight away, that there can be an instant calming.
Yeah, definitely.
Just through that, stimulating that point. And I'll carry on. It also connects to a network of fine channels of energy which spreads throughout the whole chest area and is said to open the chest. And again, that absolutely makes sense. This means one can breathe more easily and be more upright as the chi of breath holds us up. Again, that fits with the idea of the kind of line that connects not just between the emotional brain and the heart, but I believe continues sort of beyond us, into the earth and above us. So a kind of infinite line, if you like, you know, upon which we're kind of poised in a sense. And
mm-hmm. I mean, that makes perfect sense. As you say, we come to these things slightly backwards, or maybe it's forwards in the intuition side. But
yeah,
actually, for me, when I rub those points, A, I can almost feel that kind of energetic passage, if you like, or pathway between the back of the head and the heart. But also, when you say that about the little channels that spread out, I can visualise them, and B, it's sort of that's exactly what the feeling is. Actually, it's like an opening up and a kind of
I agree. And also another thing which is important for me is the sense of this kind of expanding beyond the physical body. You know, like this sort of line or connection, this energetic, sort of almost like a pole. It's not physical, although in a sense we have a physical feeling of that within the body, but it goes beyond the body.
Yeah, it's like a field, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He says opening the chest in this way will always make someone feel lighter emotionally and generally calmer and happier, which makes complete sense, doesn't it? That sense of well-being we like to talk about. He also says, consider the emotional aspects of the heart and lungs. If qi is flowing through these organs properly, then the emotions can be released and dealt with more easily too. So that's interesting as well, isn't it?
It's interesting. So, I mean, emotions... Well, my understanding of it is that emotions are just emotions. They're just feelings. It's only when they get stuck that we have the problem. So if we've got a technique here that allows them to flow, releases that stuckness, then, you know, I mean, we're meant to have feelings. They're to tell us whether things are good or bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that makes sense too.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And then, talking about the area at the back of the head, the area at the back of the head stroke base of the skull, I think you're dealing with two things here. Firstly, do 15/16, which is largely to do with speech and being able to give voice. And maybe in this context about, you know, being heard, having needs met. So, you know, thinking in the therapeutic context. So that's very interesting as well, isn't it? And that puts me in mind of how, you know, often the fear of speaking out, the fear of kind of voicing what we need to say, we experience that as a kind of literally like a lump in the throat, don't we, or a constriction somewhere around the throat area.
Absolutely, yep. So it sounds like it's all about communication, really.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So there's actually a lot going on here. There's all sorts of linking with different aspects and the sort of combination of the points. And then he says that, secondly, I think you're on GB or gallbladder 20, so either side of the base of the skull, so that's where we're resting our hand at the back of the back of the head. So this moves the liver qi and so will help to dispel frustration and enable the person to get on with things rather than being stuck in an old pattern. As a gallbladder point, it will also affect the gallbladder and may help with decision making and planning. So I think that probably links with what the guy on the steps DVD set was talking about in terms of it being used as an alternative to karate chop or the sore spot for psychological reversal.
Yeah, that makes sense too, clearing those blocks and moving forward.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so this kind of leads me to one of the questions that we have, which is actually about blocks to the heart anchor. Because we know that potentially it can be extremely powerful and make an enormous difference to our work, and yet we can also have the experience, especially when first setting it up, of either nothing much seemed to happen to me or even something which gets in the way of it and can be quite off-putting, like, you know, fear thoughts, anxious thoughts, even physical pain. So we've got a question from Gloria in the United States, who says, I still have a lingering feeling of anxiety when I anchor my heart. Is it possible for you to elaborate on how to work on eliminating this? And then she says, just continue tapping, ? So what do you think, Emma? What would be your approach?
Well, I think, first of all, to know, Gloria, that actually this is completely normal. It happens many, many times with people when they first start working with the heart anchor. So just accept that that's kind of, that can happen. And it's about flipping really into what we call fear mind. So Yes, continue tapping, but notice when you when you're doing that what the thoughts are, what the physiology is of that anxiety. How do you know you're feeling anxious? And if you can, I would be inclined to stick with doing the heart-centered tapping, but working on the physical sensations of anxiety rather than actually putting words to it. And I think you'll find that if when you're doing that, if you're silent but you tune into the actual physiology, you'll be able to go much deeper, and B, it will release, I think, quicker. Because I feel sometimes we put words on these feelings, like anxiety, and I'm sure it is anxiety for you, but sometimes our words kind of get in the way of really listening to what's going on. Mm. So that would be my sense would be, yes, just continue tapping, but using the heart-based tapping and acknowledging that this is completely normal. And then when you clear it, coming back to the heart anchor again and just sitting with it and noticing.
Yeah.
Because if you still get the anxiety then after you've done some tapping on it, the chances are that it will just move through when you've cleared that block.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I absolutely agree, and I also want to support you in saying that it's absolutely natural and kind of common for there to be some kind of blocking or, you know, fear response to this. Because when we start to use the heart anchor, we are approaching that level of the mind that knows more about you than you do. We really are approaching the level of the mind that has our, you know, our often our lost power, it has our, you know, connection to love beyond time and space, and to the part of the mind that it, you know, is totally kind of physical and you know, believes that you are the little you with all your problems and concerns and lack of faith in yourself. It's absolutely terrifying to that part of the mind. So we kind of set off, you know, a conflict that goes, we may experience that, as, you know, physically as a sense of, and actually can often show up as, you know, pain. I've had people say that, you know, it feels like a real pain in my chest or a pain in my head or something like that. But we're also kind of setting off a, you know, a metaphysical storm, if you like. And so the first learning, this often comes up on our workshops, doesn't it, Emma, on, you know, the Healing the Addicted Heart workshop or the Opening to Love, that one or other of the group will kind of, you know, present with this kind of conflict. And I actually believe that working through it in the way that you've described, you know, helps everybody. Because to a certain extent, we all have, you know, that conflict going on. So the thing to do is to say that, you know, kind of back off. And so by back off, I mean, you know, come out of the heart anchor pose. Go back to the heart-based tapping, focusing on the bodily sensations or, you know, whatever it is that you're aware of as a feeling of discomfort. And then go back to using the heart anchor when you feel that's kind of begun to clear. And it's worth taking this approach at whatever kind of level that you're at. You know, even if you've been using the heart anchor for a long time and you've got a really kind of really amazing and interesting relationship going on with it. You know, I do this myself. I will come back to a kind of clearing at a certain point because at some level there is always a kind of resistance to it or, you know, a block to it.
Yes, I was going to say exactly that. So if you clear it on the time that you're doing it and then maybe it stays clear for, you know, for a few days, weeks, months, whatever, don't be surprised if it comes back. I mean, it's just a different layer and you just treat it in exactly the same way.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, I'm amazed now at what I experience using the heart anchor and the, you know, and the kind of, you know, the creativity and the capacity for, you know, for happiness and joy that I experience now that I had no idea of. Actually, you know, even at the point when I first started to use it because we grow and we expand and so part of the challenge of kind of moving forward is that we will meet obstacles along the way, you know. So one, you know, really important learning, you know, for me, which I've tried to teach to, you know, all my students and clients, is that the path is never straightforward. There will be obstacles along the way, and that is kind of, you know, that is how we grow. So getting out of that mindset that there's like a, you know, a complete and one only transformation, and that's it, we're done, is that's fear mind that thinks like that.
Life would be very dull, wouldn't it, if that was the case? Because when it comes back, yeah. I think we get to a stage thinking, okay, this is an opportunity. What's going on here? This is an opportunity for another piece of healing to be complete, if you like.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah. Then we kind of realise that there's more, and there's more. You know, we have no idea how small we have made ourselves. You know, when we're kind of really living from the addicted heart, we have no idea how much fear that we're really living with. And as you begin to, you know, to undo that, you realize that, you know, the possibilities for love, you know, are infinite, and that you can have new experiences and new understanding and a sense of more, a sense of abundance every day. You know,
and you can do it for yourself.
And you can do it for yourself, yeah. And in fact, you have to do it for yourself, really.
Some people would wait every week to go to a therapist, but that's not using it in the way it's been designed, if you like.
Yeah,
the joy of it is that you can actually do something positive for yourself, even in a really, really difficult situation. You can still access that sense of love, even when life's going on around you in a way that you really, really don't like it.
Yeah. I think that is impossible
to having that, just that calmness within the storm that you were talking about.
Yeah. I think so, because you know one thing that I have come to understand as well is that, you know, we experience life on different levels, and you know I've kind of come to know that, you know, it may be that I'm having a difficult set of circumstances, you know, in my everyday life. You know, we all experience, you know, grief, and we experience you know, traumas big and small along the way, but it is possible to, you know, to remain connected to that sense of, you know, above and beyond and around and through all this, I am okay. I know I am completely okay.
And I kind of had an experience of doing that yesterday, actually. I was saying to Sue earlier, my daughter had been in hospital for the day. And it was complete chaos around me, and we kept waiting for hours and hours and hours. And I actually have to say, it's just holding that point, holding the heart point, and I didn't have my hand on the other one, just not only kept me calm, but I think it kept her calm as well. And people were kind of responding to us in a different way to how they were responding to anybody else in the ward, it seemed to me. I think, you know, using it, remembering it's a practical tool too in cases of kind of seeming emergencies or whatever, it's a really, really useful kind of little trick to have there.
I think that's absolutely right.
People respond to you very differently when you're coming from a heart-centered place.
Yes. And so, you know, life happens, as you know from your experience yesterday. But actually, from the heart, you do experience a different set of situations, of circumstances.
You do. I mean,
perception is. It may be the same events, but your perception of it can be completely different.
Yes, I mean, I think if I was to describe yesterday, it was kind of like, yes, it was. I was very anxious. Yes, nobody knew what was going on for her, but somehow I also knew that everything was okay.
Yeah,
and I knew that she was okay, even though nobody else knew it.
Yeah. Actually, I did as well. Funnily enough, even though I wasn't even there.
And she was. She's, you know, whatever it was hasn't gone, but we know it's nothing serious. But, you know, in amongst the chaos of being whisked away for every test under the sun, I kind of knew. It was like there was a piece of me that was just completely new.
Yeah.
That it was going to be all right.
Yeah. And I mean, initially I went through a kind of, you know, anxious stage, and then I suddenly, like, shifted into, it's okay phase. Yeah. You know, or sensory experience, really, you know, rather than phase. And that kind of happened when I got out of my own way. I think I went into sort of like an autopilot, you know, oh my God, what's going on, which is perfectly natural, you know. And then actually something deeper, something wiser took over at some point. So, I'm just thinking about that.
I think I could say that. The same for her, actually. I mean, I wasn't sitting there tapping, although I did do a bit of finger tapping on her.
Mm.
And I wasn't even sitting there holding both points of the heart anchor. I literally just had my hand over the heart point, and I was just gently rubbing it. And it just seemed to kind of, it was almost like magic. I could see people changing around me. It was actually very bizarre now I think about it.
That was
weird people's attitudes in a really, really chaotic, frantic and stressful environment of A&E.
Yeah.
People were suddenly just coming and chatting to us and just being, you know, hanging out with us, really, and having a nice time whilst we waited for the test. Yeah. It was a bit bizarre.
Yeah.
And everybody else was sort of stressed in the distance.
Yes.
It's a bit of a surreal situation, I think, about it, and I'm wondering whether that was I know it will have been.
Yeah, yeah. Happiness is catching, heart coherence is catching, actually.
I wouldn't say I was particularly happy, but heart coherence, the calmness and that sense of it's okay.
No, happiness wouldn't be the right word, but heart coherence is catching. I mean, there's this very interesting research that Heart Math Institute is really, you know, well worth sort of investigating in terms of being able to see research papers and the work that has been done. And as you're talking about this now, I'm just reminded of something which is in the research papers called the Energetic Heart. And there's some really, really interesting research done measuring the heart coherence, what's called the heart coherence of a therapist in a therapeutic encounter with a client. So, it's possible using the heart monitors to be able to, see visually on the computer screen the coherent flow of heart rhythm, you know, which indicates that when we talk about heart coherence, we're talking about a state of calm, but a kind of poised calm, in the zone, I think you might say. So it's not a sort of, calm, relaxed as in, asleep or kind of falling off your chair. It's a sort of in the moment, present, now, connected.
Active calm.
Exactly, active calm. What we refer to as connected to love. You know, we're sort of talking about love as all of the attributes of the good, the holy and the beautiful in a sense. So it's this kind of active calm. Now, in the therapeutic encounter, it is the therapist's job, in a sense, in a nutshell, the therapist's job is to achieve and maintain heart coherence. And what the research actually shows is that where the client comes into the therapeutic encounter in a state of heart chaos, and again, this can be shown by kind of jagged, spiky visual images on the monitors, showing that the heart variability rate is kind of out of kilter is a good way to put that, and that will be indicative of all manner of states of anxiety, again, what we would call fear mind in our terminology. Mm-hmm. And what starts to happen is that just literally in the presence of, in the energetic field of the person, the therapist with heart coherence, there's a kind of entrainment that happens, or literally entrainment between the hearts of the two people involved, so that rather than the chaotic dragging the coherent into the chaotic pattern, the reverse happens. So in the entrainment process, it is always the way that heart coherence leads to heart coherence. And interestingly enough, the research showed that effect was faster and it was, it was more lasting when there was actually physical contact between the client and the therapist. What they did for the purposes of the research was do it without any physical contact, and it did work, and then they did it with literally holding hands. So that kind of, two things really. One, that, I imagine that you were able to achieve heart coherence in that environment, and that was literally spreading. So other people were benefiting from that. But it also leads us onto another point about, you know, when we do work with clients, you know, the effectiveness or not of actually having, you know, physical contact, you know, actually tapping on the other person, because this, you know, research literally did show that there was, you know, faster and more sustained, entrainment of the hearts into heart coherence with the physical touch.
I mean, we should say that at the IEFT Centre, when we do our trainings and things, and certainly in our personal therapy sessions with clients, we always tap on the other person, unless there's a specific reason somebody requests that we don't,
which
hardly ever happens.
People
are always questioning us about that, whether it's better or worse.
And
we don't know. It's just that it's natural for us, and the research would imply that maybe it's more effective. If you don't tap on other people, have a go. See what happens.
Just, you know, kind of try it out. Because it actually does seem that what happens, you know, the healing effect that happens in a therapeutic encounter has to do with the heart, you know. That's a fascinating idea in its own right, but that the heart would respond, or two people's hearts would respond more through the power of touch, I think is a very important piece of information.
I agree. It's very exciting, actually.
It is, yes. It really is.
Possibilities.
Exactly. I just love this whole thing of you know, the metaphor of the heart being, you know, the seat of healing and the seat of wisdom is kind of, you know, it's just becoming the truth. It's becoming literal. There's sort of no avoiding it, really. So we're really shifting into a whole, you know, a whole new way of thinking, but, you know, by allowing the heart to teach us, you know, how to listen to the heart. In a new way, exactly, by listening to the heart.
Hopefully, Gloria, that answers your question in a rather long way about the lingering feeling of anxiety.
Yes, it's we've kind of gone into some very, very interesting points from there. But you know, to recap, it's entirely normal to have some anxiety, and in a way, welcome it. You know, welcome it, because it really does show that you're getting to that part of you, that level of reality that you know, that feels threatened. So that shows that something actually really important is going on. And I'd be very, very surprised if, you know, if you start to take this work seriously, if you never get to the point of having some kind of awareness of blocks to the heart anchor. It's part of the kind of, you know, the ebb and flow of practice.
Absolutely.
And progress. Yeah. Okay, so we've got another interesting question on the heart anchor. I think maybe we'll come back to that. I'd like to just maybe answer Sue's question, not me, Sue. There's another Sue who's actually talking about working with cravings.
Yeah, absolutely. Shall I read her question?
Yeah, go with that, yeah.
Okay, so Sue says, I've tapped for cravings before, and that does work, but this is a larger issue than a momentary craving. Is there any way to ever eat moderate amounts of a trigger food by using tapping? I feel deprived and rebellious if I tell myself I shouldn't eat X because it will trigger overeating or a binge. Is it better to address those feelings so I can cut the food out of my life forever, or is it better to somehow tap away the desire to overeat the food? I just keep eating more of a particular food, in my case Pringles, that is good for health or waistline.
Okay.
So it's a very, very common question, actually. A lot of people say, you know, how do I go about this? I can deal with it in the moment, but it comes back.
Absolutely.
I don't want to stop eating, in this case, let's say Pringles forever. I just want to be able to have, I suppose, moderation is the right word. Does that sound right to you, Sue?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
So, in a way, so you've already answered your own question. If you feel deprived and rebellious, then yes, absolutely, that's where to start. So once you've worked with your cravings, as you obviously know how to do, you've kind of got the opportunity to go kind of deeper in and look at the emotions or the kind of unresolved conflicts that are triggering this to kind of, if you like, wrong word really, but feeding this craving.
Good word.
Okay, so I would start off with you by tapping on the feelings of deprivation. You know, even though I feel deprived, I deeply and completely love and accept myself. Or going around all the points of the heart anchor. I feel deprived, I feel rebellious, I feel deprived. Things that you're saying to yourself, like, I'm going to eat it. You can't stop me eating it. If I want to eat it, I'm going to eat it. That sort of thing. And then, when you've managed to kind of reduce those feelings and got a kind of a gap in them, you want to ask yourself, it's Gary Craig's favourite question, really, what do these feelings remind me of? When did I feel like this before? Mm. When was the first time I felt like that? And the chances are you'll get either a specific memory or somebody will pop into your mind. And that's where you go next, okay? Now, how do you kind of bring the heart anchor into this?
Mm.
What you want to be doing is when you get a reduction in the craving or when you get a reduction in the feeling of deprivation, rebelliousness, any time you feel a sense of kind of calm or heading that way, that's when you want to anchor it into your heart anchor.
Mm.
Mm. And just sit with that for a little while.
Yeah, because there may well be moments of calm in between bouts of, you know, deeper feelings of deprivation or rebelliousness that in the normal way we might just completely miss.
And sometimes our unconscious mind kind of doesn't deliver what we're looking for, doesn't allow us to go there. And that's when you might need to work with an EFT practitioner of some form, somebody who's got good experience, because they'll know what questions to ask to kind of dig underneath the issue further and get the response. And also coming back to what we were talking about kind of that heart-centered space, when your unconscious mind feels safe working on an issue, which is not something you can create consciously, it will release the answer. It will give you the solution. It always has the solution.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need someone else to be able to hold that safe space whilst you go there. Because food and eating is never actually about the food. It's not about the Pringles. The Pringles just represent something for you. And it's what they mean to you. That's kind of interesting here. Because whatever it is, it's more important to you than your health or your waistline. And I mean that unconsciously. Consciously, obviously, it's not. Otherwise, you wouldn't ask the question. But so what's going on underneath it? And look for those memories where you made decisions that kind of you had to eat. What does it give you to eat? Particularly, I keep coming back to Pringles, but what does it give you? How do you feel when you've eaten Pringles? And what's the feeling that happens just before you go to the packet?
Yeah.
Things are what you want to be tapping on as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And remembering to reward yourself with the heart anchor when you do get a foot in the door. I mean, I think people, particularly around food, feel it's all or nothing. But actually, small steps is the way to go. Small, achievable steps and rewards with the heart anchor.
Yeah.
That's a much more realistic way of doing this.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I think that kind of covers what I would say in terms of what to pick out. I mean, from what Sue has said, the obvious things to pick out to work with are the feeling, you know, the deprived and rebellious feelings. What I think is interesting as well, she says something that is really, really common, that she's telling herself not to eat, you know, whatever, Pringles as it turns out, because it will trigger, this is her thought, that it will trigger overeating or a binge, and so she wants to, in a way, she's thinking that, you know, that do I need to address those feelings so that I can cut the food out of my life forever? That's what she says, you know, to, you know, never ever have, you know, have that bother me again. This kind of thought that the only way I can get out of this is by never ever having, you know, a Pringle or never ever having a cigarette again or whatever, is really common, and it's a really, really sneaky thought, because it kind of keeps us hooked into the thing.
It doesn't represent freedom, does it, in any way?
It doesn't represent freedom, and it kind of, the fear mind just kind of like digs its heels in, it's like, cause it believes that you need that thing. It totally believes that you need that thing. And so this leads me on to, the observation that people who have true freedom from, any kind of attachment, are not depriving themselves and, swearing themselves to never, ever, ever touching that thing again. They make a genuine choice in the moment about whether or not it would serve them well, whether or not it would be useful, whether or not they want to have that thing. That's...
And more often than not, the answer is no, actually I don't, isn't it? When you're put in a place of clear choice,
yeah,
you tend to find that you don't want that thing anymore. You don't need it.
Exactly. So they're sort of riding easy, within the sort of the harness of kind of knowing that they will choose what is actually genuinely best. And nobody, when they're coming from their heart, when they're coming from love, nobody chooses anything which is going to do them harm or anybody else harm, actually. So this whole kind of notion of, I have to swear off that kind of, white knuckling, I vowed that I'll never ever, have that thing, whatever the thing is, again, or do that thing, is actually kind of counterproductive to true freedom of, allowing the heart to kind of teach us, how to kind of do, how to do freedom.
So, I think that actually leads us on really nicely to a question from Joan.
Yeah.
Which maybe if I read it, you'd like to answer, which is, if one gets out of an addiction, is it easy to unconsciously pick up another one? I feel I have an addiction to money, although I don't have a lot of it, and I'm happy when I have enough money. Then I'm at my happiest.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of picks up on Sue's question, because unless you get to the core, to the drivers underneath an addictive behaviour, you're just going to replace it. You remember Gary saying that he went and gave a lecture to the, I think it was Alcoholics Anonymous in New York.
Yeah.
Whilst that program, and whilst nobody was having an alcoholic drink, what he noticed was that people were smoking, eating sweets, drinking strong black coffee, and basically they just swapped their addictions to, in inverted commas, a healthier one. But actually it's still not, kind of in your, you're still coming from a fear-based place. It's not heart-centered. When you need an addiction, some sort of behavior to kind of, if you like, to disguise and not something deeper.
Exactly. So the kind of, to go back to Sue and the, feeling deprived and feeling rebellious and do I have to, completely get over this, if you, let me put it in another way, actually. If you think of that thought as being a kind of aspect of fear mind, and yes, you might be able to sort of, white knuckle it and never, ever, ever have another Pringle again, but the chances are that because it's still, you're still coming from fear mind, that another addiction will just, pop up. Swapping cigarettes for eating is a classic, isn't it? That one, many of us have had that experience. Or whatever, alcohol for shopping. What we can do is just take that thought. I think this is actually a really important thing. And tap with it. So if you tap something like, I'm afraid I'll have to give this up forever.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just sort of do this. If you're tapping on the eyebrow point, I'm afraid I'll have to give it up forever. And then go to, the other side of that. So tapping on the side of the eye, I don't want to do that. And then under the eye, don't tell me I've got to give it up forever. Under nose, why should I give it up forever? And then going back to the actual sort of fear of it, saying it as it is, it terrifies me to think I'd have to give it up forever. So the point is that we're taking that thought, and everything that it means on all the different levels, and doing something with that to allow the opportunity for that thought to kind of transform itself. Because it's a very, very damaging thought. If we take that literally, the chances are that we are going to get sort of, you know, stuck in this, you know, white knuckling it, swearing off one thing only to have something else pop up. But while we're kind of, you know, hooked into that thinking, it actually stops us from getting at the, you know, the deeper kind of unmet needs that always underlie, you know, our kind of need to fill ourselves up, you know. But we can get hooked on one thought which seems to imply a certain course of action that then becomes all consuming, so we don't actually get deeper. See, my nose how to stitch us up. No, exactly. It's a very, very kind of tricky thing. And quite often we're not actually picking up on the thing that's staring us right in the face, which is to, you know, not take our own thoughts so seriously, but just take the thought and find out what happens when we tap saying it as it is, as the thought's occurring to us. Does that kind of make sense? It's sort of paradoxical, but.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So just looking again at Joan's bit of her, what she's saying about, you know, feeling that she has an addiction to money, although she doesn't have a lot of it, and that she's happy when I have enough. When she has enough, she's at her happiest. And I guess, although she doesn't actually say that, that at certain points she kind of thinks and feels that she has enough, and then that can change, and she no longer is full, if you like. She's no longer at that point of feeling complete.
So one of the obvious things here is Joan, to check out what enough actually is, because the unconscious don't understand that word. It's too vague.
Yeah.
So, you know, is enough, I don't know, what is enough for you? If I come up with an actual sum.
Yeah. What are you experiencing when you have that sense of it being enough? And actually, when she's in enough, it would be worth kind of putting enough, that sensory experience of, you know, how does she feel that in her body?
That into the heart anchor.
Putting that into her heart anchor, because in a way she's doing what, you know, most of us do at some point, is giving away her power to you know, that temporary sense of enough, which is connected with money. So she's giving away her power to money, thinking that gives her enough. But actually, she's self-generating that feeling of enough, isn't she?
Exactly.
And if she can reclaim that back, take that back for herself, you know, how amazing. Wow, you know, I can touch my heart anchor points and experience that feeling of enough. So that's actually a great example of how to use the heart anchor to disrupt this, you know, these tricky ways of thinking that do keep us stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Thank you, Joan.
Thank you, Joan. Yeah, we like that one. Which actually leads us back to Denise from London's question, which was, it was about the heart anchor. There's two or three parts to the question. She says, can you use the heart anchor alone to clear problem states? And how does this work?
Mm-hmm.
So that actually fits quite nicely with what we've just been talking about with Joan. If she's able to generate that experience of enough and anchor that, and then take that back to herself so that she's no longer giving that away, giving her power away to money. That's one example of how you can use the heart anchor to clear problem states. I mean, we do this a lot, don't we, Emma? It's kind of, it's more sort of advanced work with heart anchor. Essentially, once you have set up your heart anchor, so that it's kind of reliably working, that, you know, when you touch the points, you're able to shift your state, then it will kind of have enough power to transform negative states. And all you do really is fire the heart anchor points and then kind of bring the negative into it. It's a bit like, you know, moving your cursor on the computer screen and, you know, picking up a file that you then plop into the trash can and feel that, you know, you hear that kind of ping as it explodes, or you do on a Mac. Anyway.
So it explode.
dissolves in a satisfying kind of ploppy noise. So that would be how you would do it. If we're just thinking about a simple kind of like, you know, one emotion situation, for an example, just say you've walked out into the street and you see somebody dropping some litter, somebody on the other side of the road dropping some litter, and you can't say pick up that litter, you can't really do anything about it, so you're kind of angry in that sort of powerless sense. If you were to just catch yourself in that moment and fire the heart anchor whilst you're also feeling that negative, I guarantee something very interesting will happen. So maybe try that the next time that you catch, you know, you catch yourself in a kind of moment like that, where you get a sudden sort of strong, possibly kind of uncomfortable, or definitely uncomfortable, although kind of, you know, temporary feeling. Just find out for yourself what happens when you kind of like put that in to the heart anchor. Emma, perhaps you'd like to say something about how we might use the heart anchor in a therapy session to clear a problem state. So if you can think of an example.
Okay. I can think of lots of examples.
But yeah.
I think of a client recently who was having, well, she's having terrible problems with her mother, actually, but she didn't know why.
Mm.
She was just kind of really, really angry with her, suddenly rage, having been pretty close. And suddenly she couldn't explain what these feelings were about. And all she knew was that she was pregnant, and she thought maybe there was something to do with that, and she was, hormones were activating something or whatever.
Yeah.
And actually, she'd kind of given me a clue that up until recently, she'd had a very harmonious relationship with her mother. It had all been, you know, they'd been very fond of each other, very close. And her mother obviously was picking up on whatever was going on and was getting upset and therefore becoming more demanding and wanting answers and wanting to know what's going on and trying harder too, which mm-hmm. was actually having the complete reverse effect on my client. She's just irritating her more and more and more. So we did some initial tapping around a kind of the extreme, well, it was guilt really was the predominant thing, guilt and lack mm-hmm. of understanding as to what was going on. And then as we were clearing this, actually, it was quite interesting. She started just saying more and more, remembering more and more times when they'd been very, very close.
Hmm.
So whenever she remembered one of those times when she got into that particular state, I kind of build it up a bit for her with my language. So you go, what's it sound like? What's your mother look like? How you know, etc. And I'd use the heart anchor to anchor those feelings. So having done that and having established quite a strong anchor actually over a couple of sessions, or three sessions I think it was, started to move into the future. So, okay, so your mom's going to turn up. She's going to be wound up. She's going to want to know what's going on. She's going to say all the things that irritate you so much. What happens when you look at that, when you've got from a heart anchor space? And it was extraordinary. Her whole concept completely changed. She started to kind of reframe it for herself. Oh, well, you know, I can just see that she's just really anxious. She loves me. She wants to help. None of these things, which although might be obvious to you and I, as we're I'm talking about it, none of this stuff was in her conscious mind at all. It was just, I've got to get her out of here. I don't want to see her. She's driving me nuts. I don't want her to have anything to do with the baby.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't get to what was going on underneath it in this instance, but actually we didn't need to. I don't think it's always necessary to start picking those things, pieces, if you can get a quick change by using the heart anchor in that way.
I agree. Yeah, no, I agree totally. And what you're describing is what we see time and time again, is that people literally see something different, don't they? Their perception changes in that there, you know, as with your client in her imagining, she saw, you know, her mother with a different expression on her face. She heard her voice tone differently. She felt a whole different kind of atmosphere around the thing.
She did, and the mother was doing the same thing. You know, the mother hadn't changed here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I imagine, I haven't seen her since that last session, but I'm imagining that when she sees her, the relationship will have changed, and therefore the mother will have reverted back to how she was before as well.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all, and I'm not surprised because it's based on the experience of hundreds of these kind of reports.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a kind of example of what we call looking through love's eyes, isn't it?
I had a similar thing with another client last week. Actually, who's doing the same thing, but in a relationship issue. And I got a text from her afterwards going, I don't know what happened in that session, but my feelings towards my partner have completely changed and everything's fine.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, and what happened was that she accessed that heart energy.
Yeah.
So forgiveness in a way, not forgiveness of a crime or anything, but just a kind of forgiving space.
Exactly, yeah. Just, you know, it's a shift in vision. We come to see differently.
Exactly.
Or I guess it's the kind of vision that goes beyond, you know, what you see through your eyes, I guess.
I think it's quite important to point out that if something, you know, if something bad, in inverted commas, has happened, we're not going to make it good. We're not going to make it better this, but we are going to make it better, but we're not going to make the actual event, change the event. Something that's bad that's happened, like, I don't know, like being mugged or something, is a bad thing. You know, we can't suddenly make that good, but what we are doing here is changing the perception and the way it's kind of programmed into our neurology.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, that was kind of linking in with what I was going to say about, you know, in the book, if you look up, you know, the kind of, you know, the exercise or the process, which is looking through love's eyes, we, you know, apply this to memories for, you know, from the past, and literally we will, when we have kind of shifted from fear to love, so therefore that's, you know, the idea of looking through love's eyes, which we kind of you know, we tune into that by using the heart anchor, we will literally see something different about what happened in a memory. Well, we know what happened, but we using this, we get people to kind of test out the changes in a memory by looking in two different ways. So looking in the old way and just seeing, you know, what's happened to that movie now, and maybe it will have lost, you know, the intensity of the feeling, some of the negative feelings have dropped away, you know, the details of it, you know, maybe it's kind of, you know, it's faded or something like that. And then if we look through love's eyes, firing the heart anchor, it's possible to actually see something kind of unfolding under our, you know, before our eyes or through our eyes, which is a different version of the thing, which has something to teach us. So if you haven't tried that out, you know, look up the looking through love's eyes exercise. There's an example of it in the case study, which I think is in the identity chapter. It's an amazing experience to have for yourself. It's
it really is very powerful.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of Anita's question actually. The other part of it is, and does this tie in with building new neural pathways in the brain?
Yeah.
Like transforming from a state of anxiety to a state of peace, and my answer to that would be absolutely.
Yes, completely. Yeah, yeah.
They're not new; they're just forgotten. They've gone been dormant, I would say, because they've always been there. They've just not been active.
Yes, or they've sort of remained in potential only, if you like. And then the more you do that, you know, which in this terminology is the more, you know, you build these new neural pathways, then the more they become the natural way of seeing, the natural way of being, the natural way of experiencing your life, because there's a literal kind of physiological representation of them in the brain. You know, a new pathway has been carved. you know, we're talking metaphors here, but they're kind of, you know, it is literal in the sense that a new structure is created in the brain that then, you know, then fires off the, you know, the kind of physiological analogs that go with, you know, with happiness, positivity, confidence, you know, recognizing, you know, the good, as the natural way of being. And then, you know, when you're kind of, not experiencing that, you know, in my own experience, if I'm not kind of experiencing feeling great and balanced, I'm really interested. I think, you know, how fascinating, you know, something's going on. And it doesn't worry me, you know, it doesn't make me kind of think, you know, oh my God, I've lost everything I'd ever gained. It's just, it's kind of, you know, fascinating and allows me to kind of, you know, get even more sort of, you know, into my own process of, you know, of undoing, you know, the past and my own process of healing. So I'm welcoming it. And I guess that there's a neural pathway that goes with that, you know, with the welcoming.
It's a perfect antidote to guilt too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, absolutely. So, actually, just from a very practical point of view, there's something that I mentioned in the book about, you know, creating new neural pathways. And some NASA research which is done into, you know, how long it takes to establish a new neural pathway that relates to a different kind of behavior. And apparently it is measurable as being 21 days. That's how, so for instance, if you switch from, you know, if you switch from a behavior pattern like, you know, always feeling angry and irritated, you know, when your partner does a certain thing, you know, you do some work on that and you have a moment of, you know, forgiveness or awakening when you see it differently, you see it through different eyes, you would need to, you know, anchor that and keep putting yourself into that kind of mindset in order to have that become the default position. So it's like sort of allowing the time for the seedlings to come through, and mixing metaphors wildly here, but, you know, to come through and become established, and so that's then the, you know, the kind of natural way of being. It's good, you know, goes back to a really important point, which is that change can and does happen in a nanosecond. You know, just like that, we can switch our minds, and potentially everything is different and can be sustained that way. But there is a period where we have to kind of make that effort to allow it to flourish and to keep sort of removing the, you know, the weeds that are growing up around it and can potentially kind of, you know, strangle the new growth that's coming through.
That's the time when fear mind is at its most active, actually, too. It'll try and sabotage you. So just be aware of that. Just, I would say, be persistent, absolutely persistent. You know, put it into your diary to practice this 3 times a day or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But whatever else is thrown at you, you've always got that which is growing and growing, which will ultimately help you towards solution.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, because it, you know, in that moment of just that moment of sort of hope, or the moment that it just occurs to you that things could be different, that can, you know, that can be your new world, your new life, providing you're able to dissolve the obstacles in the way. And the first step towards doing that is to just expect that it'll happen, because, you know, as you say, you know, fear mind gets really rattled when it thinks that you're about to change. You know, it wants you to stay small because it believes that's all you are, you know, and the truth about you is that you are so much more than you think. You are so much more to discover. You have so much more to discover about yourself than you may have thought up until now, and in any moment of any day, you can re-decide. You can change your mind, and you can make this moment, mm-hmm, the one
Absolutely. I think that brings us actually very nicely to Sally Ann's question here about how did you formulate this idea that there's only one basic reason for addiction and what can cause this in an individual?
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what I mean? The really simple answer to that, and I talk about this in the beginning of the book, in the introduction to Healing the Addicted Heart. I had a series of kind of inspirations that came as like sort of words being spoken to me, and yet I knew absolutely that it was me speaking to me. I guess it was, you know, it was my higher self speaking to me. And you know, the words that came were, all my problems have to do with losing sight of love. And when that thought came to me, it was this moment of, oh my God, you know, all potential is in this moment of this thought coming to me. And simultaneously, there was terror. You know, there was absolute terror because, you know, the two sides of my mind were, you know, really kind of, you know, alive, and each, you know, it was like a sort of, you know, I guess a sort of vying for which, you know, which way would I go? And I didn't understand the words, and I knew that there was truth, and the terror was, you know, actually, I mean, even though I thought, you know, I longed to be free of the, you know, the problems that I had, you know, the drinking and the smoking, I longed to be free of it. And yet there was this, you know, there was this terror, really, of, you know, of becoming more than I thought that I was. And you see, all of that was kind of unconscious. I'm trying to, you know, sort of describe something that, you know, I couldn't possibly be aware of all of the implications of that. So what I have to say, and I'm trying to answer this simply, is that what has unfolded since then, and, you know, culminates with, you know, the me that's sitting here now talking to you, I know to be the truth, you know, encapsulated in those words, that all my problems, which really means all anyone's problems, have to do with losing sight of love. That has been borne out along the way. And it's kind of, you know, it's been a long journey with some really kind of, you know, desperate obstacles and pitfalls along the way. And I guess what, you know, my gift has been is to be able to put into the form of the book and the other work that I'm doing and that you and I are doing together, Emma, a way that other people can follow that doesn't have to be quite as kind of tortuous and difficult as the way that I followed. If I'd been able to sit with myself then, back then, and say, you know, there's no need for your fear. You know, this is absolutely the truth. You know, just get out of your own way and let it unfold. That was kind of, that's what I'm trying to give to other people now, really, that kind of reassurance that this is the truth. You know, deep down, you know in your heart that this is the truth. And so
I think
it is.
There's so much to be said for that word "no," because when Sue says, you know, I know this is the truth, she's coming from a place of inner knowing. It's not just an academic "I know, so you've got to know this too." It's just, there is no other option. This is how it is. And she's got that inner knowing from having lived it, if you like, which I think is very different. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's absolutely right. It is, you know, when I say no in that way, it's kind of not what they teach you at school. it's the knowing of the heart.
It would be very different, wouldn't it? The world would be a different place if they taught it at school.
It would.
One day soon.
Yeah, one day soon, absolutely. So thank you to everyone for being with us on this call, and time now to say goodbye for now, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for some really interesting questions.
And thank you, yeah.
Do keep in touch with us.
Bye for now.